Hey, thanks so much for listening to this message. My name is Jason, and I'm one of the ministers here at the Madison Church of Christ. It's our hope and prayer that the teaching you hear today will bless your life and draw you closer to God. If you're ever in the Madison area, we'd love for you to stop by and study the Bible with us on Sundays at 5 p.m. or Wednesdays at 7 p.m. If you have questions about the Bible or want to know more about the Madison Church, you can find us online at madisonchurch.org. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast as well as our sermons podcast, Madison Church of Christ Sermons. Thanks again for stopping by. I hope this study is a blessing to you.
So last week, in preparation for this class, I gave you some readings from Habakkuk, Ezekiel, and Jeremiah, and then 2 Kings. And so those were your readings for this week. And as we, or if you read those, one of the things that might have stood out to you was this whole idea of how the Israelites hadn't kept their end of the bargain with the covenant with God. And they had kind of broken that promise or that covenant. And so I kind of start off with the question, you know, in your life, have you ever been in a situation where someone has broken a contract or an agreement or a significant promise with you, and how that make you feel? I'll share with you two things. Amy and I do most of our own home improvements, except I've hired contractors twice. The first contractor got a third of the way through, and his master carpenter quit, so he quit. So I had to finish the roofing and electrical and all that. Then I hired a guy to do our spare bath, and he put the tub in and then broke it, cracked the tub. And so then he left, so I've had to redo his work. So for me, when something happens where someone breaks an agreement with me or a promise with me, it makes me very leery to ever make an agreement again. So, you know, I'm going through a process now of getting some estimates to do our master bath, but in the back of my mind, I'm like, well, I'm gonna wind up doing it myself, so whatever, but it really makes me leery. So when someone breaks that covenant, breaks that agreement, breaks that promise with you, oftentimes our response is, well, we're not gonna ever do that again with that person. And so it's gonna be interesting tonight as we see this relationship between the Israelites and God, how God continues and actually offers even a better promise or a better covenant. So let's talk a little bit. Most of us don't read a lot out of Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and Habakkuk. So let's kind of walk through a couple of main things about those books. And let's start with Jeremiah. So Jeremiah is very unique. It's a very unique letter, very unique prophecy, in that he provides the messages that God gives him to publicly talk about, but yet he also shares his private prayers and the private conversations he has with God. So it almost gives us a kind of like behind the scenes of what it was like to be a prophet. Also, if we go to Jeremiah 36, verse 23, it says, Jehudi read three or four columns. The king would cut them off with a knife and throw them into the fire in the fire pot until the entire scroll was consumed in that fire that was in the fire pot. What was happening is Jeremiah was dictating the prophecies and his assistant was writing them down. The scroll was then taken to the king and the prophecies were being read. Well, the prophecies weren't that great. We'll see where Jeremiah was warning him that they were going to be taken over by the Babylonians and thrown into exile. So as the scroll was being read to the king, he would read a little bit. The king would then take his knife and cut off that part of the scroll and throw it in the fire and burn the scroll. And so Jeremiah had to redictate his prophecy to his assistant, and the assistant writes him down. So when we read the book of Jeremiah, what we see is it's not arranged in chronological order, because the first part of the scroll got cut up and burned by the king. So it is arranged more topically, but not necessarily chronologically. And Jeremiah was prophesying before the Judah was carried off into captivity. And then you have Ezekiel. So Ezekiel was written while the Israelites, while Judah, were in exile in Babylonia. One of the things that's very unique about Ezekiel is he gives you a date. He'll say in the 9th year or the 12th month of the exile, I received this vision or had this vision, right? So Ezekiel actually gives us the date in which he received the messages or the visions that he wound up doing the prophecies for. And then what you'll see if you read Ezekiel is that he has these spectacular visions that wind up being messages for the people. Of the three, my favorite is Habakkuk. So Habakkuk was a contemporary of Jeremiah and Zephaniah, which means he did prophecies before the exile as well. And if you start off with Habakkuk, what you'll read is that he gets very upset when he sees how the people of Judah are living. He gets very upset over the evil that he sees in Judah, and he prays to God and says, when are you going to take care of this? Well, then God tells Habakkuk that he is going to take care of it. He's going to take care of it by having the Babylonians come in and take them all over and carry them into exile, which was not the answer Habakkuk was expecting, right? Well, then that kind of upsets him even more, because now he's like, well, why would you do that? And it's a great book, and it closes in chapter 3 with one of the most powerful prayers that we read. And I just pulled two verses out from Habakkuk 3:17-18. It says, though the fig tree should not blossom, nor fruit be on the vines, the produce of the olive fail, and the fields yield no food, the flock be cut off from the fold, and there be no herd in the stalls, yet I will rejoice in the Lord. I will take joy in the God of my salvation. So Habakkuk says, even when all these bad things are going on, crops don't come in, olive trees don't produce, there's no animals, there's no herd, even though all these bad things are going on, I'm still going to rejoice with the Lord. And so those are kind of a little bit of background of the three books that you had readings out of for this past week. So let's talk a little, let's review a little bit where God's plan was revealed in the Mosaical Law, or that covenant. And we talked about a covenant being a little bit more than a promise, but we talked about that covenant. We also talked about that when we see Jesus in the Old Testament, we see Jesus as prophecies, as promises, and then as types, or an example of something that's going to happen in the future. So the covenant had contingencies. If the people followed the covenant, then they would be blessed. However, if they broke the covenant, if they quit following God, if they quit those things, then in Deuteronomy, God told them that he would scatter them among all the nations. So this was well known to the Israelites before this time that we see with Judah. But God gave them hope. In Deuteronomy 30, after he says he'd scatter them, he says, if the people turn back, that God would have mercy on them and bring them back. So we kind of have this covenant that's made with the people. They're given the law, they're given these things that they're to do, but they're warned if they don't follow those things that God would scatter them, but yet God would always be there to welcome them back. But what we see by the time we hit Jeremiah and this time in Judah, remember you had the northern kingdom and southern kingdom. So Israel, the kingdom, got broken too, all because of kind of tribal, the one set of tribes didn't want to follow the one king. So they broke into the northern kingdom, southern kingdom. The northern kingdom, Israel, they're no more for a long time. So now you just have the southern kingdom or Judah. But what we see at this time, as we talk about with Habakkuk, in Habakkuk 1, 2, and 4, Habakkuk says, the people are not following that covenant, that law. Notice at that very last, next to last verse, it says, so the law is paralyzed and justice never goes forth. For the wicked surround the righteous, so justice goes forth perverted. So what we see is the law is actually forgotten. people didn't listen to Moses, Isaiah, Habakkuk, or Jeremiah. So why did the people ignore God's message, right? God sent prophet after prophet, and why did God ignore them? The great thing about Jeremiah is Jeremiah lists four reasons why they were being ignored. So let's take a look at those. So reason one, in verse 2 of Jeremiah 7, says, God instructs Jeremiah to stand in the gate of the Lord's house, and there you're going to proclaim there for everybody to hear. And then verses 5 and 7, it says, if you truly amend your ways and your deeds, if you truly execute justice one with another, if you do not oppress the sojourner, the fatherless or the widow, or shed innocent blood in his place, and if you do not go after other gods to your own harm, then I will let you dwell in this place, in the land that I gave of old to your fathers forever. So Jeremiah's primary message is that they needed to repent and need to turn back to God. If they did all that, they could stay in the land. If they didn't, the Babylonians would then carry them off. Brody, I missed a chance for a map. If you were here a couple weeks ago, we had the map of Assyria. So we saw where Assyria had conquered pretty much what's referred to as the Fertile Crescent, which runs all the way down to about the border of Egypt. The Assyrians were taken over by the Babylonians. So it's the Babylonians that are the rising power. They're the power that is really the world power at the time. And so Jeremiah's forewarning the Israelite, folks in Judah, if they did not turn aside, the Babylonians would come and capture them and put them in exile. And then, I know this is pretty long, but I'll pull out just a little bit in 8 through 15. It says, behold, you trust in deceptive words no avail. Will you steal, murder, commit adultery, swear falsely, make offerings to Baal, and go after other gods that you have not known? And then come and stand before me in this house, which is called by my name, and say we are delivered. Long story short is the people were doing whatever they wanted to do, but still going into the temple and making those sacrifices, but making them with an unrepentant heart. And so to them, as long as they kept going to the temple making sacrifices, God would not put them in exile. And so what we see for that reason one is the people thought they could sin freely. They thought they could do all these things, but as long as they just maintained those temple sacrifices, even though they weren't very repentant of what they had done, that they'd still be safe. Right? There was that thought of that era. They thought that as long as they lived, that they could please God and not have to suffer any of those consequences as long as they kept offering the sacrifice. Even though in their heart they weren't repentant of the things that they were doing, they were still keeping doing them after those sacrifices. Look at Romans. Kind of reminds me of Romans chapter 6, verses 1 through 14, where Paul writes and says, you know, we've got grace that covers our sin, so does that mean we should sin more to receive more grace, right? To me, when we look at what's going on, that first reason, it's very similar to what Paul says in Romans chapter 6, just because we have grace doesn't mean we can just keep on sinning. It means that we've got to change. We talked about last week that we got to examine ourselves. We got to repent. We got to confess. And we got to make that change. So it reminds me a lot of what Paul says in Romans chapter 6. Then what you'll notice at that reading that we had, Jeremiah reminds them of Shiloh. So if you wanted to think about Shiloh, you got to go back to 1 Samuel chapter 4. So the Israelites were going to go do battle with the Philistines, and they got defeated. And they questioned, well, why did we get defeated? Because God's supposed to be with us. So they decided to bring the Ark of the Covenant. And it kind of reminds me of that image that we see in Indiana Jones, because to them, they thought if they brought the Ark of the Covenant, that they could use the Ark of the Covenant like a weapon and then wipe out the Philistines. They didn't understand the significance of the ark of the ark, if you will, but they took it, brought it from Shiloh, took it into the battle against the Philistines, and they got beaten again. And not only did they get beaten, but if you remember Old Testament history, the Philistines actually captured the Ark of the Covenant and carried it back with them. So Jeremiah is trying to tell them their idea of the temple is just as wrong as the idea they had about the Ark of the Covenant when they were back in Shiloh. That the temple wasn't some tool to keep them safe, but rather it had a specific purpose. So Jeremiah tells them, or when we ask why don't the people listen, Jeremiah says reason number one is people at this time thought they could do whatever they wanted to. They could make their own rules. They could make their own decisions based upon their feelings and not on the commandments that God gave. So reason number two, if you go to Jeremiah 19 verse 3 and 4, it says, "You shall say, hear the word of the Lord, O kings of Judah, inhabitants of Jerusalem. Thus said the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, behold, I am bringing such a disaster upon this place that the ears of everyone who hears of it will tingle, because the people have forsaken me and profaned this place by making offerings in it to other gods, whom neither they have their fathers nor the kings of Judah have known, because they filled this place with the blood of innocents." If you remember last week, we talked about, if we go back and look at Manasseh, who was probably one of the most wicked kings within Israel history, actually sacrificed his own daughter to the god of Baal. Other kings of Judah did the same thing. They had taken and used God's temple, the altar in God's temple, not to just make sacrifices to God, but also to make sacrifices to other gods of the land. And so here, Jeremiah is telling them, and then in verse 15, after he says all this, he says that they have now, because they have stiffened their neck and they refuse to hear my words. So that second one is, they didn't really want to hear, the people really didn't want to hear that they were doing something wrong. And I think back about our nature. We often talk about, has someone ever came to you and said, "Hey, I want to give you a little bit of constructive criticism." So what's the first thing we do? Well, we get a little defensive. You know, we have that job interview and our boss goes, "Oh, here's the good things, but let's talk a little bit about the bad." We don't like hearing things that we don't want to hear. And so one of the reasons that they ignored these prophets, Jeremiah says, is because they were stiff-necked and they didn't want to hear it. They didn't want to hear those things. They didn't want anyone telling them what they were doing was wrong. They didn't want anyone telling them that the way they were living was wrong. You know, not many people like being told that. Let's look at the third reason. Jeremiah chapter 20. Now, Pashur, who is the priest, he heard Jeremiah prophesying these things, and then the priest beat Jeremiah, the prophet, and put him in the stocks that were in the upper Benjamin gate of the house of the Lord. So here we have a priest, we have a prophet of God, and when the priest hears the prophecies from that prophet, the priest beats him up, beats him, and then puts him in the stocks. And so the third reason Jeremiah gives that they didn't listen is that they ignored the prophets because their leaders told them to. Their leaders said, don't listen to them, but rather listen to us. The priests, at this time, the priest had actually stopped publicly reading God's word to the people. So anything the priest said, the people tended to listen to. At this time, there was no godly leadership, either in the priesthood or in the king, and there was no instruction. Remember, we talked about that the priests, one of the primary roles of the priest was to provide instruction, and at this time, none of that was taking place. And then reason number four, notice we'll just jump down to the last part. Do not listen to the words of the prophets who prophesy to you, filling you with vain hopes, They speak visions of their own minds and not from the mouth of the Lord. So it seems that as Jeremiah is making these prophecies, that there are other prophets, false prophets, who are saying things exactly the opposite of what Jeremiah is saying. And so you have these false prophets speaking their own mind, giving a contradictory story to what Jeremiah said. And so we have false prophets who are telling the people what they wanted to hear versus what they didn't want to hear. And so we look at all this and we'll summarize this. The prophets were ignored because they thought those temple sacrifices without having a repentant heart would save them. They didn't like the true message of the prophet. They had ungodly leaders to them that told them to ignore the true message, and they have false prophets that misled them. So we look at those four things about why the prophets weren't listened to, and it kind of takes me to 2 Timothy chapter 4, where Paul writes to Timothy and says, "For the time is coming when people will not endure sound teaching, but having itching ears, they will accumulate for themselves teacher to suit their own passions and will turn away from listening to the truth and wander off into myths." So once again, we look at the Old Testament. We talk about the Old Testament being a pattern, the Old Testament being a shadow. We see things happening in the Old Testament that mirror what's kind of happening during the New Testament, that first century, but then even into today. Now, I didn't read that last sentence, because if we look at these four things that are facing us, the question is, well, how do we overcome those? How do we fight those four things? That last sentence tells us to always be sober-minded, endure suffering, and then do the work of an evangelist. Because all of us, right? We talked about last week, the light to the world. That's the goal, that's the role of each and every one of us, is to share that light into that gospel. So those things that we see from the Old Testament, 2 Timothy tells us, Paul tells Timothy, here's how you overcome them. So you have Jeremiah prophesying to the people about what's coming and is basically being ignored. Now, I'm a history fan. My wife actually can teach English or history in junior high and high school. So we're big history buffs. So if I don't have a map, I usually at least have a timeline. So I think it is kind of important for us to see these final kings of Judah in kind of a timeline. So in 609 BC, we talked about that you had Egypt here, and you had the Assyrians, the Babylonians. It would come from the Middle East, then come up the Fertile Crescent, and then Judah kind of set as a buffer. So in 609 BC, Egypt marched north to do battle with Babylon. The king of Judah at that time, he decided he would hitch his wagon with the Egyptians. And so he went and took the Israelite army that was left in Judah, aligned with Egypt, but he died in battle, right? So that was 609 BC. Then you had Jehoahaz reigned for 3 months, and then Pharaoh exiled him and then put Jehoiakim on the throne, but he was basically a vassal. He was basically a puppet king with Egypt controlling the king. And then 605 BC, remember we're in BC, so we're doing a countdown. So in 605 BC, Babylon came in, conquered them. Egypt was not a superpower. Conquered them, changed the king to be his vessel, and then took some of the nobility back into exile, including Daniel. So Daniel was in this group that was in 605. Against Jeremiah, Jeremiah told the king, "Don't rebel against Babylon because they're going to take you anyway." He did. Babylon attacked. He died in 598. His son reigned for 3 months before surrendering, and they imprisoned the king, most of the wealthy, and all the leadership. They placed on the throne against Jeremiah's counsel. He rebelled against the Babylonians, and then the Babylonians besieged Jerusalem, And it was just a horrific, horrific siege where a lot of those in Jerusalem died, and then Jerusalem fell, and then they carried off the rest that remained into Babylon. Now, God didn't abandon his people, because what we see when they got carried off into Babylon, that you had Daniel and Ezekiel were prophets to the Israelites who were in exile. They were in different parts of Babylon, though. So Daniel was in the capital city, Ezekiel was in a different part, but both of them prophesied to the people and remained with the people. Jeremiah was part of that remnant. If we remember, there was a remnant that stayed in Jerusalem, and Jeremiah was one of those that actually stayed in Judah, and he continued to talk to the people who had remained there. So that's kind of the timeline. Now, if we look at Ezekiel, remember, Ezekiel was not in Jerusalem. He was in Babylon. But when we look in chapter 9, he had a vision. And in his vision, it says, "Now the glory of the God of Israel had gone up from the cherub on which it rested to the threshold of the house. And he called to the man clothed in linen who had a writing case at his waist." So he has this vision where he is in the temple that's in Jerusalem, and he sees God who's on the cherub, right? There was a cherubim in the most holy place. He saw God descend or leave the temple on top of that cherub. And so imagine, if you will, that in Ezekiel's vision, he watched the glory of God depart the temple entrance, right? It left. Now, if we go back and we read Ezekiel, what we see is that God really didn't leave the country. It just simply says that God left Jerusalem and then moved to the mountain. So we get this impression that even though God isn't in the temple, he's not abandoned his people. And then Ezekiel was sent to the east gate and given a message to provide to those who've been exiled of a coming judgment as well as hope. And that hope was this hope of this new covenant. And this is where we start seeing Jesus in these stories in the Old Testament that foreshadow or show what's coming in the New Testament. It's this whole idea of a new covenant or a new promise. So look at Jeremiah 31, starting with verse 33. "For this is the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel after those days, declares the Lord. I will put my law within them. I will write it on their hearts. I will be their God. They shall be my people. And no longer shall one teach his neighbor and each brother, saying, Know the Lord. For they shall all know me, from the least of them to the greatest, declares the Lord. For I will forgive their iniquity, and I will remember their sin no more." Look at verse 25. "Oh, I will sprinkle clean water on you, and you shall be cleansed from all your uncleanliness, and from all your idols I will cleanse you." And so we start seeing this whole idea of this new covenant, and we know that part of that covenant is going to involve water, and water is going to be used to cleanse. And if we look at verse 26, Ezekiel prophesies that "I will give you a new heart, and a new spirit I will put within you, and I will remove the heart of stone from your flesh and give you a heart of flesh." So there's going to be a new heart. There's going to be a new spirit. And this is God, who's the I, that's going to be put within them. Ezekiel 36, 27. "And I will put my spirit within you and cause you to walk in my statutes and be careful to obey my rules." So we see this prophecy about this new covenant. It's going to be different from the old covenant, because now with this new covenant, in the old covenant, God didn't dwell within the people. God dwelt within the temple. But now we see where God says, "I'm going to put my spirit within you during this new covenant." Isaiah 49 and 8, as well as 53:10, tells us that, remember, we talked about a suffering servant, and that suffering servant would bring a new covenant and be the offering for guilt. That's so small. I'm sorry. But if we look at Ezekiel 37, 23 through 28, it talks more about the covenant. So for example, if we drop down a couple verses, it says, they and their children and their children's children shall dwell there forever, and David, my servant, shall be their prince forever. So once again, God had made a promise to David that all this would be established through his lineage, and God's keeping that promise, that it's going to be someone within David's ancestry that's going to take care of this. And so we see the promise of this new covenant. And then what we see remaining is most of the Israelites felt the exile was bad. Worst thing that ever happened to them. So a lot of what you read, a lot of rest from those books, is that even though they thought it was bad, God pointed out the good that came from the exile. So for example, in Ezekiel and Jeremiah, at this point, leaders were taking advantage of the people, and so it removed the bad leaders that were in Israel. It stopped the rich from oppressing the poor. It brought judgment to the wicked. It destroyed that temple. That temple had been defiled. There were offerings made to false gods. There were children, child sacrifices being made. The temple was destroyed by the Babylonians. And so through the exile, that defiled temple was destroyed. It taught discipline to the people. So now the people would fight sin. It showed the need for God's rule. And so what we see, it also showed God's grace. So all these things the prophets talked about, that even though the exile was bad at the end, there was going to be good that came out of it. So this made me think a lot about 2020. Made me think a lot about COVID. And was there any good that came out of COVID? And I know that COVID was terrible on families. I'm not in any way saying it's not. But for me, so pre-COVID, I traveled 2 to 3 times a month in my job. In May of 2020, my dad was diagnosed with cancer. My sister was in her 5th year battling cancer. Both of them were in poor health. I kind of drifted away. My sister and I kind of drifted apart. And suddenly in 2020, all travel was shut down. So I was the one who took dad. I was the one, even though my sister lived in Tennessee, dad was in Tennessee. She couldn't take him to treatments, things like that. And so I would often take him to treatments. I would drive from here to Paris, and we'd get up and go to Nashville for his treatment. Treatment's 4 to 5 hours. So I would go spend that time with my sister while he was in treatment. Then I'd take him back to Paris. And I think about that if it had not been COVID and I'd been traveling 2 to 3 times a month, I would not have been able to take care of my dad. My sister and I spent more time together in 2020 than we had since we both lived under the same roof. And we reestablished that connection. And we prayed, and we prayed together, and we spent that time together. And if I had had that normal travel schedule where I'm traveling 2 to 3 times a month, I wouldn't have been able to do that and reconnect with her. So for me, as bad as 2020 was, there was some good things that it allowed me to be able to do, right? And so I think part of the things that we as Christians always have to strive to do is strive to look for the positive, even in those negative situations. So let's jump to the New Testament. As I look to see our time, it's just telling me I've reached my standard. All right, so let's look at the New Covenant. I'm gonna start off with the New Covenant. I'm not gonna read it because you are all familiar with Matthew chapter 5, verses 3 through 12, but this is the Beatitudes. This is where Jesus summarizes the new covenant, right? Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs will be the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be satisfied. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall receive mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when others revile you and persecute you and utter all kinds of evil against falsely on my account. Rejoice and be glad, for your reward is great in heaven, for so they persecuted the prophets who were before you. So Jesus starts this idea of this new covenant, this new promise. When we go through the Beatitudes, are there any of those that give you comfort more than other ones? You know, for me, blessed are those who mourn, so they shall be comforted. I mentioned 2020. My sister passed in October of 2020, and then Dad passed in 2022. But that whole idea of when we're mourning, of getting comfort, not just from God, but from our church family, right? To me, that means a lot to me. Are there any of these that are challenges? I'm gonna be honest, sometimes it's hard, I think, for us when we look at that being meek or being humble, right? I think it's kind of hard for us sometimes because a lot of us have great jobs and we look at our position as something that we've put together. So we look at that and there are things that are challenges and there are things that are great comfort. But then look what Jesus says in verses 17 and 18. Do not think that I have come to abolish the law of the prophets. I have not come to abolish them, but to fulfill them. For truly I say to you, until heaven and earth passes away, not an iota, not a dot will pass from the law until all is accomplished. Look at that word fulfill. You know, for us, when we look at that word, the definition is that it bring it to its intended goal. So Jesus is saying all the prophecies that we've covered so far, everything that you've read in the Old Testament, its goal is coming till today when I'm here. And Jesus says, I've not come to abolish the law, but rather to fulfill, to bring it to its intended goal, where he makes that link between himself and the prophets. Jesus, we talked about the prophecies in the Old Testament, are prophecies, promises, and patterns. We see that Jesus fulfilled every promise that was made. He fulfilled every prophecy that was made. And we see types, patterns, in people, institution, and events. And Jesus fulfilled all those types that were foreshadowed in the Old Testament. And so we see him saying that he has fulfilled, he will fulfill that law. And then finally, Jesus fulfilled the commands of the law by expressing their intent. Remember, the Pharisees had put a hedge around the law and put additional things around the law, but Jesus kept the law by keeping the intent of the law and following them perfectly. And then Jesus begins teaching on God's kingdom, about God's kingdom. If we go back to Ezekiel 36, 25 and 27, you know, God makes a promise that he's going to clean with water. He's going to give new hearts and new spirit. And he's going to put his spirit into them so that they could obey. John 3:3, Jesus says, truly, truly, I say to you, unless one is born again, he cannot see the kingdom of God. And in verse 5, he says, unless one is born of water and the Spirit, he cannot enter the kingdom of God. So this is when Nicodemus came to Jesus at night. I'm going to jump real quick. So one thing about that coming, let's go back. One thing about him talking to Nicodemus, the Old Testament was quite clear that water was used to cleanse. Why Nicodemus, or why the leaders, hadn't made that connection between what Ezekiel wrote and what Jesus was saying, I'm not sure. But the Old Testament talked about water purifying, water cleansing. And so it shouldn't have been that big of a stretch for Nicodemus. And it probably was, because this is not the only place we read about Nicodemus, right? When the Sanhedrin was trying to have false people against Jesus, Nicodemus spoke up and said, "Is that the way we do things?" And they made fun of him, they ridiculed him. When they went to claim Jesus' body, Nicodemus bought the perfume to put on the body and went with Joseph to get the body. So between the time Nicodemus came to him at night to his crucifixion, Nicodemus had become a follower of Jesus. And so we kind of see that he's made that connection. So let's go a little bit to this last part. So Hebrews, especially chapter 8, the writer of Hebrews spends the time convincing the Jews why the new covenant is better than the old covenant. And in verse 13 of chapter 8, he says the new promise makes the old promise obsolete. And if something is obsolete, what should it do? It should vanish away. It should go away. It's fulfilled its purpose. So the Hebrew writer is saying that new covenant makes the old one obsolete. It fulfills the obsolete, so therefore it goes away. Hebrews 9:1-14 talks about how that Jesus' blood purifies completely, while in the Old Testament, those sacrifices just made people outwardly clean, but they didn't solve the problem that were on the inside. And then I'm going to go to this last one, because I felt like I got a pretty good example, and so I'm going to go through it. Now, some of you in my audience, when you see that a bounced check, you'll know exactly what I'm talking about. There may be some of you in the audience who've never written a check or don't even have a checkbook. But in the old days, we would use checks to pay our bills. And so the Old Testament, if we looked at those sacrifices, the Old Testament was a check that the Israelites wrote, and that check was to cover the debt of sin. So they had sin in their lives, they made a sacrifice, they wrote a check, and then handed that over to God. And the form of that check was that animal sacrifice. The Lord, in His grace, because He's a gracious Lord, He accepted that check, but He didn't cash it. Because He knew if He cashed it, it would bounce, because the blood of bulls and goats could not take away that sin. So now when I was in college, the first thing you did as a college student was you would find a place where you could write them a check and they would hold it for 2 days. Because as a college student, you'd run out of money, so you'd write a check. Mine was the guy who had a comic book shop. I'd write a check, he would hold it till Friday, and then he'd give it over to the bank, right? Lord knew that there was no money in the account to cash that check, so He held it. So the biggest question is, well, if God knew that the check would bounce, why did He accept it anyway from the Old Testament? Because Hebrews 10:10, verses 12-14 tell us that God knew there was going to come a time when our bank account, there'd be money in that account. God knew that there'd be a time where Jesus' blood would be in that account and those checks wouldn't bounce. Those checks would be good, right? Knew that Jesus' blood was going to accomplish what the blood of bulls and goats could never accomplish, and that would be to completely cleanse us, both on the inside as well as the outside, and make us, as we talked about last week, a future righteous people. So, final thoughts, real quick. This week, I got all the A's. You know, let's work on acknowledging God as the giver of mercy, acknowledge our sin, ascertain or ascertain our identity in Christ, amend our mistakes as much as we can, actively pursue accountability, and then alter your heart. And then next week, let's read Daniel chapter 1, verses 1 through 6, Daniel chapter 7, Daniel chapter 5, 2 Chronicles 36, 22 through 23. And to kind of help you, I put some of the dates, that those are written there as well. But read those for next week. Write out what stands out to you and why. And I know I went right past the bell, so you guys have a good rest of the week. And we'll see you Sunday.